Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. I'm your host, Matt Calder, and today we have a packed show for you. But before we get to all that, I want to talk about subscribing to the podcast. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do that simply by going and searching What Matters in North Carolina, where you listen to podcasts, and you'll get these episodes on your phone or whatever other device you want to listen to podcasts to without any effort whatsoever from yourself. Again, that is searching What Matters in North Carolina, where you listen to podcasts. If you want to follow along with us on social media, you can do so on Facebook and Twitter by searching What Matters NC. You can like the Facebook page, and you can follow our Twitter by searching What Matters NC. If you want to listen to more episodes of this show or more shows on the Freedom Action Network, you can do that by just going to the Freedom Action Network website, which is freedomactionnetwork.com. Again, that is freedomactionnetwork.com. So, today we will be talking with Francis DeLuca about the annual unaffiliated poll the Civitas Institute puts out to gauge the temperature of what is swiftly becoming the second largest voting bloc in the state. Now, when it comes to elections, a lot of times the Democrats are going to vote for the Democrats, the Republicans are going to pretty well vote for the Republicans, and in a lot of ways, politicians are fighting for those unaffiliated votes. So this poll gives you the chance to see what's going on with that group, and the Civitas Institute will be having a breakfast for that on Thursday at the Holiday Inn in downtown Raleigh as well to announce those results. Next up, we will be speaking with Brian Balfour to talk with us about what's going on with the Durham-Orange County Light Rail Project, and to talk with us about the costs associated, the possible benefits, possible downfalls, and what's happened with Charlotte's light rail system, and also talking about where the money's going to come from and how far that money could go if it were to be spent on road projects as opposed to light rail, which is inherently an inflexible system as the train tracks are where the trains go. Then we will finish up with Brooke Medina, who you heard on the show for the first time last week, and Demi Dowdy to talk about the recent internal memo from Google about gender equality in the workplace that then went viral and went out to the world to be read and no longer be an internal memo, and the backlash for the engineer who was fired as a result of it, and really just getting their opinion about what was in the memo and Google's response to the situation. So right now, we will talk with Francis DeLuca. Now, we are joined by Francis DeLuca, president of the Civitas Institute, who's going to talk with us a little about polling. How are you doing today, Francis?
Doing good, Matt. Thank you. And I want to talk a bit about generally polling and then specifically about something we do every year, which is an unaffiliated poll. And polling in general, one of the useful things, a lot of people tend to hear a poll and they kind of go, oh, is that what people think, or that's wrong, or, you know, that's, I agree with it, so it's right. That's usually a lot of people's first reaction. But polls are useful, really, when you use them to track the changes in public opinion over time. And it's not an exact science. It's more of an art, because the way you ask the question matters and who you ask the question of matters. So that's one of the reasons we do polling. Quite often, you know, multiple times a year, we poll North Carolina voters, likely voters, only people who are registered to vote, and of those, only people who actually vote, because not all registered voters actually vote, and that shouldn't surprise anybody, because not everybody on the voter list is, in fact, even here. So once a year in August, we do what we call an unaffiliated poll, and we poll 400 unaffiliated voters, just unaffiliated voters, and these are people who are either newly registered or voted in the past. So if they registered years ago and never voted, we don't poll them. But if they're newly registered, we poll them, or if they voted in 2016 or 2014, we poll them. So in this August, we're going to poll unaffiliated voters, which, and Matt, you've heard us talk about this many times, it is the fastest growing group of voters in North Carolina. In fact, you know, sometime after you hear me or before you hear me, they may actually pass Republicans as the second largest group of voting bloc in North Carolina. I'll call it that, you know, unaffiliated voters will be the second largest identifiable voting bloc in North Carolina. And Susan Myrick, who does some segments here, may actually talk about that in the very near future, if not today.
Right. That's what I was actually thinking about while you were bringing it up, the unaffiliated poll. I'm going, you know, this is becoming a more important thing to do because it's something you've done in the past, but it seems to be becoming more important to have that because those are, in a lot of ways, the votes that are being fought over, right?
Correct. You know, even among the registered Republicans or registered Democrats, some of those people are up for grabs, but less and less because as the parties shrink as a slice of the voting public, their mix becomes more and more partisan. Now, Republicans are actually still growing in North Carolina. There are more registered Republicans today than there were in the 2016 election. There are less registered Democrats than there were in the 2016 election. Democrats have been kind of hemorrhaging voters for a number of different reasons. A lot of them switching. They're not registering as many people as they used to, so they're not making up for the people who are aging out and dying. But that's really not what we're interested in this poll. We're interested in unaffiliated voters, and we're going to be releasing this poll after we conduct it on Wednesday, August 23rd. And we're going to do a breakfast. We usually do breakfast, lunch, dinners, and this one we're going to release at breakfast on Wednesday, August 23rd at 7:45 a.m. in Raleigh at the Holiday Inn downtown. So if people happen to be in Raleigh or want to come to Raleigh and eat breakfast and talk about the poll, we're going to have John Davis commenting on it. John Davis has been in around politics in North Carolina for several decades. He likes to describe himself as a unaffiliated observer, you know, that he's not a partisan. He's a disinterested observer of what happens in politics, and he says he tries to call the shots as he sees them. But John gives he's done most of the unaffiliated polls. He has been a commentator, so he's familiar with the history of this and can give a little bit of perspective. But we will be, like I said, 7:45 a.m., the Holiday Inn downtown. That's the Round Holiday Inn. And if they go to nccivitas.org, under events, they can find it, and they can sign up for the poll. And it's, you know, good breakfast and good information. Now, what I wanted to do is kind of talk about some of the things we asked. And we ask these things year after year. We've been doing this poll since 2010. So we have a history of what unaffiliated voters in North Carolina think back to the 2010 year, and which is good because we can see if they're thinking differently this year than they were last year. And we were able, because of the polling of the unaffiliated, we were able last year to say that Donald Trump was going to win the election because he had the support he had among unaffiliated voters more than made up for any loss among the Republicans and Democrats he may have been experiencing. Unaffiliated voters were pretty supportive of Donald Trump, and we saw it either directly in the numbers or in the numbers about how many of them disliked Hillary Clinton. So that's also a key. It's not just who they like, it's who they dislike. And we'll be talking about things. Do they generally feel North Carolina is heading the right direction or wrong direction? Their generic ballot on the legislature, which a lot of people in North Carolina will be interested in. We ask about their ratings of the president, of the governor. We ask lots of questions about just how they are. Do they consider themselves to be liberal or moderate on fiscal issues, social issues? What do they think of taxes? What do they think of voter ID? Bunch of questions like that, because it's a chance to drill down into the unaffiliated voter. Again, like I said, the second biggest group of voters in North Carolina, if not today, next week or the week after. We ask them about their opinion of school choice. We also ask them, in terms of political party, do you identify more with the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, or something else? And people tend not to understand this about unaffiliated voters. Unaffiliated voters, even though they're unaffiliated, they tend to have partisan leanings, just like everybody else, just like registered Republicans, registered Democrats. They tend to identify either as a Republican or a Democrat, and a strong Republican or a strong Democrat or something in between. Now, a number of them will say that they are, quote-unquote, unaffiliated, but a good percentage of them, probably greater than 50%, usually identify themselves with one of the parties. So this is always a good way of tracking which way the momentum is going. And we see that shifting over the years. We see it kind of ebbing and flowing as to which way they're headed. Are they headed towards the Republican direction? Or are they headed towards the Democratic direction? And a lot of that follows a news cycle. It also follows how people are feeling about the president and the reelection. So we'll get a good indication on this one in terms of how they're viewing the Trump presidency here in North Carolina.
Well, that's interesting, and I'm actually unaffiliated myself, so I'll be waiting for my call. Be one of the 400.
Yeah, if you do that, run out and buy a lottery ticket, because you know when you think about how many millions of unaffiliated voters there are in North Carolina, for you to get a call is almost like winning the lottery. That's what people tend not to understand. And they go, well, how can a poll work if you call so few people? And the fact is that with 400 people, we can actually get a sense of what the whole state thinks, not just unaffiliated voters. We wouldn't say that these represent the state, because it's not, because we're calling a specific set of people, and not everybody has an equal opportunity to participate. But when you call just 300 or 400 people in a group, you can actually model it, and this is where the statistics and science comes in, and say, this is what those people think, and you can be pretty sure you're close. Now, can you say that's 100% accurate? No. That is why we always give it, there's a plus or minus. In other words, if you do it so let's say 100 times, plus or minus whatever percent it is, in this case, probably about 4%, you'll come out with the same numbers. And you'll do that 95 out of 100 times, because about 5 times out of 100, you're going to get a completely different answer. And it's not going to be a good sample. I mean, science understands that you will not get it right every single time. And that's why you have the reliability and the confidence level, is that you don't, that's one of the reasons I always tell people, never take one poll as gospel. And one of the reasons our polls are very useful and user-friendly is because you can compare polls to each other. And when we're doing them repeatedly during the year, we'll sometimes see a number that's an outlier. We go, well, let's see if that comes back to where we think it should be, or if it continues to go that way, and that's actually where people are headed. Because sometimes you'll get a blip in the number, but it was a blip in that poll, not in the real way people are thinking. And when you do them over time and you graph them, it kind of levels out that noise.
So before you throw your hands up and, you know, press pull the fire alarm on a poll, you should wait and see if it continues.
That's correct. And you never know in the individual poll, is it wrong or right? You, like I said, it's what I tell people. Polls are snapshots. And the most important thing in polling is a trend line. In other words, if you're looking at issues or at politicians, you should see where the voters are trending to. And like I said, we do this once a year so that we can establish a trend line of unaffiliated voters in North Carolina. We've got now data back to 2010. We can tell you what they thought on these issues back in 2010, what they thought last year, what they think this year. And let me put in a little plug again. We'll be releasing that Wednesday, August 23rd at 7:45 a.m. in the Holiday Inn in downtown Raleigh, and at nccivitas.org. You can buy tickets to that breakfast, pretty cheap breakfast, good breakfast. We still have room. We've got a lot of people already registered, but we still have room.
Well, will there be coffee? Because 7:45 comes pretty early in the morning.
There will be coffee.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us and talking to us about the poll coming up.
Thank you, Matt. Always a pleasure.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again, or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com, or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day, Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. So we have Brian Balfour joining us now at the Civitas Institute, who, in light of a recent, I guess, movement forward on Durham's light rail project, is taking the opportunity to kind of rehash the issue and talk with us about it. How are you doing today, Brian?
I'm doing well, Matt. Thank you. Yeah, so what inspired this really was an article in the Raleigh News and Observer recently, and they were kind of celebrating this another step forward in this process of bringing this Durham-Orange County light rail project to fruition. And just kind of to quote real quick from the article, they say, "Fortunately, the process took a strong surge forward last week with a green light from the Federal Transit Administration to move the 17.7-mile light rail project to the engineering phase. This step will be the last design step. With the blueprint complete, the federal government will decide whether to provide 50% of the project's $2.47 billion cost." Now, one thing that leapt out of me immediately from that was that figure, the $2.47 billion cost, because we've been following this project for a while now and tracking it. And just last spring, when we were writing about it, the estimated price tag for it was $1.6 billion. That's more than a 50% increase in the projected cost estimates. And before the project has even broken ground, it's still in the planning phase. So, I mean, if this is a harbinger of things to come in terms of the finances for this project, it doesn't bode well for local taxpayers.
Right. So, I mean, that's kind of a big wow number. And I mean, I think about how expensive that's going to be based for how many people it'll serve is my question. I mean, because, you know, different types of public transportation, you got buses, you have light rail, there's some other options, but those are your big options, I guess. And a bus line can change and move, and I mean, and light rail really doesn't have that option. I mean, you make a track, and that's where your track is.
Yeah. I mean, light rail is typically, you know, it's much more permanent in nature, and also, you know, speaking of projected costs, so the projected costs are already increasing before the project has even started, up to nearly $2.5 billion. And typically, the norm for these type of projects across not only the U.S. but across the world, basically, is that for these light rail projects, they're notorious for running well over estimated costs. For instance, we've had this experience down in Charlotte in the recent past. Their light rail project exceeded projected costs by about 2.5 times. So now, when it's all said and done, we're looking at, you know, just kind of given the history of light rail and the expensive nature of it, this Durham-Orange County line could very well exceed $5 billion in cost by the time it's said and done. You know, and then you brought up kind of the relative efficiency of light rail versus other means of transportation. So let's just kind of break this down real quickly. This cost for this project, this light rail, Durham-Orange light rail line, that's projected to cover 17 miles, at a cost of nearly $2.5 billion. That comes out to $145 million per mile. That's just for the construction costs. And that, of course, that's on the slight chance that they actually keep the costs under those projections. Now, compare that $145 million per mile compared to estimates of what it costs to construct a 4-lane urban highway that can be built for roughly about $8 to $10 million per mile. So that means this light rail project is going to be about 14 times more expensive per mile than 4-lane highway. I mean, which do you think would move more traffic?
I mean, and that's it. I was just hearing that number, $145 million a mile.
Correct.
That seems insane. And with the possibility of being double that, you know, $300 million a mile, and that is just I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around that figure. And then the fact that it's not flexible in any way, and it's not, that's what always gets me about it. I mean, we're you know, New York City is a walking city, or, you know, they have their subway system and everything's so compact. We're not like that in North Carolina. Raleigh and Durham are separate cities, they're close cities, they're large cities, but you're not going to be taking a train or a subway from somewhere in Raleigh to Durham. I mean, that's it. You know, look at Raleigh, how expanded Raleigh is. We're here in North Raleigh in this office. I may need to go downtown, or I may need to go to some other part of Raleigh. I need a car to get there. I need a car to get there, and I don't see there being enough trains in the world to change that fact.
Yeah, absolutely right. And you know, on the subject of density, you know, there's been lots of studies done about this topic of light rail and the kind of population density required for it to even make the, you know, come close to making economic sense. And, you know, Raleigh and the Triangle area is one place that had been evaluated by a lot of these studies, and they say it's nowhere close to being having that kind of population density for that to make sense. And then, you know, this kind of gets back again to, you know, what's a better use of these scarce resources? I mean, if we are going to spend, in this case, say, $2.5 billion, you know, we can get this 17 miles of light rail track that's inflexible, and people need to drive their cars to go park and anyways to go, you know, to catch the light rail line anyways. And think about how many passengers it can move. This light rail line is projected to carry, on average, 622 passengers per hour. Conversely, highways can accommodate 2,200 cars per lane per hour. So this four-lane highway, for example, could accommodate 8,800 cars per hour. Compare that to 622 passenger hours for the light rail. So basically, you know, for the same amount of money, we could construct nearly 250 miles worth of four-lane highways for the same price, for the same price tag as this Durham Orange County light rail line. And not only that, the light rail will carry only about 7% as many commuters. So, I mean, it's just mind-boggling, especially when you start looking at the opportunity costs, you know, what we could be spending this money on to try to mitigate congestion, try to make sure traffic flows and it's more convenient for people to get where they need to go. I mean, it's just light years difference in between how efficient these funds could be allocated, you know, just using this four-lane highway as an example compared to the light rail. I mean, it's just absolutely absurd, you know, and people around Raleigh sitting in traffic jams and bottlenecks all the time in their cars day after day, you know, if they're looking at this like, oh my gosh, what could we do with 250 miles worth of four-lane highways? How much better our commute would be if we had that. Instead, we're going to be stuck with this light rail boondoggle that's going to be carrying you know, a tiny fraction as many people.
So playing devil's advocate for a minute, I mean, that's kind of, I guess I could hear a light rail proponent saying a sort of that same sentence in a way, saying there's so many people on the road, we need to get some people off of the road, maybe not bigger roads, and get people on light rail and public transportation to take that car off the road. But I guess what's your answer, or is that feasible? Or maybe you're just the other side, you're the curmudgeon who just can't see the picture, can't see the big picture, is kind of what they would describe your viewpoint as. But what's the answer to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great thought, but the reality doesn't bear that out. I mean, people don't stop driving when there's a light rail option available in a community. Ridership, actual ridership typically falls well short of the projections. There's only a very small fraction of people for which the light rail is going to be useful for them. Like we said, I mean, it's a very specific track. And so, you know, what are you going to do? You get up in the morning, you got to drive to the light rail station, you got to wait until the thing arrives, and then you got to go to a specific destination. And what if that specific destination isn't anywhere near where you're trying to get to, say your office, for instance? So it's only serviceable, it's only useful for a very tiny fraction of the people anyways. So even if people wanted to get out of their cars and say, hey, I'd love to take a light rail to work, but it's just not convenient because it's not going to drop me off anywhere close to my office. And so how do I get to work then once I'm dropped off and I'm, you know, 5 miles away from my office anyways? So, it's just not practical, even for people who may otherwise want to take that. It's just not practical for them to do it.
Right. And that's, I mean, I'm from Johnston County, so I have a 45 minute commute on a good day. And what would I do? Would I drive to the nearest, you know, let's say, you know, I'm here in Raleigh, I'm talking about as if we had it in Raleigh, but would I drive to the nearest location, leave my car there all day while I hop on a train and then come back to my car that night. I mean, I can't see that for myself at all. And I think a lot of people are in that same booth. I mean, you can show me how it goes to my work, but what if I need to go and pick up my daughter in the middle of the day because she's sick? Do I have to work with a train schedule to try and get back to pick her up, or can I hop in the car, go pick her up, take her to the doctor?
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, you're hitting on another great point. It does not offer the kind of flexibility that a lot of people need. You know, like you said, if something comes up, you've got a family situation, you need to leave early. You know, so now what are you going to do? You can take the train all the way back to Johnson County, get in your car, and then drive to go pick up your daughter. You know, there's just a lot of inconveniences that are presented in this sort of case. So there's multiple legitimate reasons why light rail is only capable of providing service to a very small fraction of the population, whereas, you know, other alternatives like, you know, building more highway, building more lanes, you know, working on ways to alleviate the current bottlenecks that we see, you know, would be a far greater benefit to passengers and commuters and travelers around the Triangle area.
I mean, I'm right there with you on this. I can't see myself being an adopter of light rail. I did use public transportation when I was in college. I used the bus system, and I this was even when I had my truck, because my truck was parked a mile away, or more than, it was almost 2 miles away at the freshman parking lot, and the bus was a better option in a lot of ways. But all I had to do was be in that one town. I had to be in Boone. That was all I had to do. And it worked for me there, but it's just not the reality of the area we live in. I'm right there with you.
Yeah, and compare also, you know, these kind of new innovations that are coming online that offer more flexibility. You know, we have the Uber, the ride sharing. I mean, there's talks about self-driving cars that are coming closer and closer to fruition. I mean, think about the flexibility those offer, and at a far, I mean, unbelievably more efficient, you know, price point, you know, cost to people than this, again, inflexible, inconvenient, wildly inefficient in terms of economic terms, you know, wildly expensive light rail. And we're talking just about the construction costs here. When we're talking about that $2.5 billion price tag, that's not even taking into consideration the ongoing operation costs year after year. And typically all these light rail projects, they need to be subsidized year after year just for the operations, because, you know, they charge the tolls or the tickets for the light rail ride that's much lower than sufficient to cover the cost. So then taxpayers are on the hook for subsidizing it year in, year out as well. I just think it's terribly inefficient use of scarce resources. And when resources, especially this amount of resources, $2.5 billion, maybe even up to $5 billion, are directed towards inefficient means, society is made worse off.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up right there. Can't really add too much to it. Thank you for coming on and talking with us about the light rail project.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again, or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com. Or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com.
All right, joining us now, we have Demi Dowdy and Brooke Medina. They are both of the Civitas Institute, and they will be really, we're bringing Demi in for her Mad Minute / this segment, because it's a really exploded situation on social media that I'm sure everyone has heard about, with Google and the internal memo that has now gone external further than they ever imagined, I'm sure, resulted in the firing of an engineer and a lot of discussion about gender equality in the workplace. So we have a couple of people opposite of my gender in my workplace who are going to be with us to talk about this. So how are y'all doing today?
Good, Matt. Thank you.
Doing great. Thank you.
So can you, I guess, Brooke, we'll have you give us a quick rundown of what the situation is that to kind of get us started.
Sure. So last week, apparently it was released that the memo that challenged Google's diversity and inclusion programs, that memo was released into the mainstream. James Damore, who was the author of this memo, had begun to just release it to people within his own sphere, maybe friends, coworkers, but then it spread like wildfire. And that memo was basically challenging Google's claims to diversity training and inclusion, and he just offered a few suggestions as to how they could potentially look at it in a better, more objective light.
Okay, so that sounds reasonable, but if you look at the news accounts and what's going on social media, it sounds like this guy is like the biggest misogynist who just says that, you know, women can't do good in the technology field. It's the way it kind of reads in the on the internet, on Twitter, I guess.
Yeah, so Brooke wrote a really, really excellent piece that's on nccivitas.org right now, our website. And she kind of lays out some of those details and some of the hypocrisy of the anti-inclusiveness that memo has been branded with. And not only anti-inclusive, but they have said that this employee, former employee now, is anti-woman and that he is anti-diversity. So, you know, those are very fiery things to accuse an individual of, especially an individual as accomplished as James Damore. Is that how you pronounce his last name, Brooke? Damore?
Yes, I believe so.
And he has a very established career in his field. So to be branded with these things is going to follow him forever at this point. And so the irresponsible media has, I think, played the biggest role in destroying his reputation. So, you know, Brooke, you wrote a really excellent piece. Do you want to speak more to Matt's question?
Sure. So, I mean, when we're dissecting really what happened here with James Damore, it becomes obvious that his citation of Google possibly having an ideological echo chamber rings very true.
Right.
So the hypocrisy of Google shutting his thoughts and ideas down is evident from the bat. As soon as they fired him and let him go, what initially happened was, like we have mentioned, the memo was released to the public and then commentary flooded in. And so there was that pressure, especially from the mainstream, the commentary that flooded in, as you said, Demi, labeled him as a misogynist and what was that word that they used? They were referring to him as basically as someone who inherited that white male privilege and was dominating others with it. Right. And there was speculation that if he had people that were subordinate to him at Google, they couldn't trust him to actually look out for their best interest because of these misogynist tendencies. So it's just interesting that they made a huge issue out of what otherwise could have been an actual rigorous intellectual dialogue on the matter. So not only was he ostracized by Silicon Valley elites and leftists basically everywhere, he was painted, like you said, as this misogynist, a knuckle dragger, a Neanderthal, so somebody that just is completely out of touch. Right. Mind you, this man has attended Harvard and MIT, but what of that? Anyway, so Google's vice president of diversity, Danielle Brown, she issued a response to Damore's memo, and she wanted to emphasize that Google was all about fostering a culture in which those with alternative views, including different political views, feel safe sharing their opinions. Well, where was that when James Damore shared this very well-articulate memo?
Right.
Can we jump back to Google has a vice president of diversity?
Funny. I wonder how much he gets paid.
Is it? I mean, Who is their vice president of diversity is my first question.
Yes, her name is Danielle Brown, but all I know is that she shut down her Twitter quickly after this all came crumbling.
I'm sure she did. Was that like wrong of me? Was that anti-woman of me to assume that was a man in that role?
It was probably
very ignorant, because of course it's not a man in that role.
That's the thing I'm going. I'm hearing vice president of diversity, and this guy, this DeMore guy, is getting fired and all this. I'm going, there's no way that this position is filled by a man, by a white male.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
There's no way that person will be hired for that position, which isn't in of itself kind of what they're talking against, I guess. But that's what the memo's about, isn't it? It's about how there's all these programs trying to lift up certain segments of the population that cut out other segments of the population. Right. So in their quest for equality and battling oppression, they are oppressing. They are discriminating intentionally.
Yeah, and so I'm a woman who's very supportive of women's equality and women's rights. And I think I am the old school style feminist. Mm-hmm. But the new school style of feminists would argue that women need to be hyper equal to men. And I say hyper equal because they want extra rights that give them deference that men haven't even ever had. And so when you get to the point where women are no longer equal to men, but are being given extra privileges just to make up for the male privilege that they think they see, that's not really women's equality in my book. And in fact, I would say that undermines women's empowerment, because on our own standing, we should be able to be successful and to thrive based on merit.
Absolutely. I think that those statements, Demi, about what real old school feminism looked like. I mean, let's think about Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, women like that who fought for the actual rights to at least have the same voice in the marketplace and in politics as men. I think they would be appalled at what they see nowadays, which is this push from feminists, third wave feminists at that, to dethrone men, and not even dethrone them, because we're complementary. Women and men are complementary, but to basically attack this idea that men can bring nothing to the table, and therefore the society needs to be run by women. And it's shallow thinking that's very short-sighted and takes nothing into account of actual biology, which James Damore, horrendously decided to employ, was just some statistical information and some well-documented psychological research on biology. And, feminists that are around nowadays just won't hear of anything like that.
Yes.
So I've actually looked up a little bit during this about who Google's VP of diversity is. So she was in charge of diversity at Intel until very recently. At the end of June, she started with Google. So she's, a month into this job.
Oh, I feel kind of bad for her right now.
Dealing with a very, a firestorm now, a month into this job. And but she was doing, so Intel has people who work around diversity, another tech company. So this is something that I wasn't aware of, that there were people in these big corporations whose job it was to promote diversity specifically. I did not realize that was a thing at all.
Oh, well, if you go to the Google website, it's pretty interesting. So you go to their the inclusion page, which is linked on our article, and they have different subpages that exclusively focus on diversity of Googlers based upon their race, everybody except for those that are white. Also, there are Greglers, so people that are probably over the age of 50. There are gagglers, so people that identify as LGBTQ, et cetera, et cetera. And there is a veteran section, so hats off to Google for that one. But otherwise, everything is exclusively focused on gender, age, disability, and sexual orientation and race.
Hmm. That's interesting.
That just seems very divisive, though. It seems like there really is this pulls everyone apart. I mean, I went to the article on ncivitas.org. And So there's the Asian Google Network, the Black Googler Network, the Filipino Network, there's mm-hmm. American Indian, Veteran, Indus. I don't even know what one of those is. And you're right, though. There's the women, there's the disability one. There's 12 groups here of separating Google employees. If we had 12 groups in this office, everyone would be in their own group.
That's true. You know, and Matt and Brooke, what I think is so interesting, too, about this is, you know, we have our own criticisms of censorship that Google is employing. But at the same time, they're a private business. So, you know, while there's no danger in this situation of the federal government overstepping or undermining First Amendment rights, we're talking about a new trend in private businesses censoring their employees, and not just censoring them and telling him he shouldn't distribute this memo anymore, firing him. And so what does the future look like for Google, and what that backlash might be, do you think, Brooke? And what is the future for other businesses?
Well, I would say that anytime ideas are stifled in that marketplace of ideas and political correctness is shoved down people's throats, we're going to have groupthink on one hand, and we're going to have people that are too afraid to speak up on the other, because as we have seen in Google, there are ramifications that are monumental when someone speaks out against the powers that be, especially the progressive ideological left's opinions on what society ought to look like.
Right.
And so the thing is, James Damore isn't somebody that is promoting bigotry, racism, misogyny, if you actually read his memo. Mm-hmm. So if you just rely on news headlines and commentary, you will not understand the full picture of what actually the point he's trying to convey, which I'm going to actually quote him.
Yeah.
He said, "My larger point is that we have an intolerance for ideas and evidence that don't fit a certain ideology. Treat people as individuals, not as just another member of their group. So let the individual merits of someone speak for themselves." So as people are losing their minds over this memo, they're forgetting the bigger picture here, which is that each person, if they work hard, those merits should speak for themselves, regardless of race, gender, sexual orientation, disability, anything.
And that's why he's saying, look at the individual. Don't just brand somebody and write off the rest of their merit.
Mm-hmm.
That's really good. That's helpful. And I think moving forward that, you know, that's why this fight against censorship like this is so important. And it's not just like advocating for conservative ideology. It's advocating for everyone's rights under the First Amendment to voice their opinions on anything. So I don't mean to fully change the subject, but recently Lena Dunham overheard a flight attendant in the airport talk about the transgender issue, saying that, what was it exactly they said? I think something like they wouldn't want their child to go to school with somebody who was changing their gender, and that was a complicated thing for them to share with their kids. And they were not against those transitions, and they thought it was unnatural. So clearly, according to Lena Dunham, that was hateful speech. She chose to tweet the airline that they were employed by and asked that they be fired.
Yep, and they actually opened an investigation on that.
That's right.
Which is absurd to me. However, like you had mentioned,
but they found nothing.
Nothing, which is, you know, hilarious. That's just, you know, Lena Dunham being Lena Dunham.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we recognize American Airlines and Google's rights to be able to shape the culture of their company.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
But we also have the right to challenge that culture that they are shaping and say, okay, you give us a place at the table. Give the James Damores of the world a place at the table. And if their ideas are really that bad, then let them die on their own. You know, let's see which ideas float to the top. Let the cream come to the top, right? But if we can't handle that rigorous intellectual debate on such heavy topics, then, you know, are we really being intellectually honest? Are we really advocating diversity as Google espouses?
Right, and allow for that conversation to happen. And allow for that debate to happen. And if the other side of the conversation can't handle it, then they can't handle it. They shouldn't be silenced to avoid that challenge.
Absolutely. It's time to roll up our sleeves and, you know, get into this ideological, intellectual mire that we find ourselves in, because there are some good, important thoughts on both sides of the aisle regarding the issues that face our day. But we will never be able to progress like the progressives claim to want progression, right, in thought and in culture. But if we can't wrestle with these ideas in an adult fashion, then we're just regressing.
Absolutely. I agree.
I mean, that's definitely, we're entering a time, or are deep now in a time where you're not allowed to have an opinion outside of the overarching opinion, or powerful opinion. And that's right. Exactly the type of thing that has been campaigned against for decades. And, you know, and now we're at a point where it's just right back there. But mm-hmm. Nothing else to add to it, I don't think.
No, that was a good chat. That's kind of scary.
Oh, definitely. So thank you both for coming on the show. Again, that's Demi Dowdy with the Civitas Institute and Brooke Medina as well. And
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you to Demi and Brooke for taking the time to walk us through what their opinions are on the Google memo situation and what happened with their engineer, James Damore, from really their perspective as women who are in the workplace, talking about the memo about women at Google or women in the tech industry, and talking about Google's equality efforts and whether they are misguided or working or what. Thank you to Brian Balfour for talking with us about the Orange Durham County light rail train transportation plan and the progress with that and where things are heading, and about where that money could be spent in a more flexible and better and maybe more efficient way than light rail, which tends to not really get that much traffic as it is already existing in Charlotte currently. Also, thank you to Francis for taking us through the Civitas unaffiliated poll, or talking with us about the unaffiliated poll and why they have the unaffiliated poll that they do every year in the summer in August, and also telling us about the breakfast where they will be announcing the results of that poll on Thursday morning at the Holiday Inn in downtown Raleigh. Again, that is a breakfast and not a lunch as many of their poll events are. That is a breakfast. And if you want more information about that, you can go to the Civitas website at nccivitas.org. Now, thank you to our guests, but also thank you to you, the listeners, for taking the time to sit down or take us on your drive, listening to your radio, if you're listening to the show, or listening on a device, if you're listening to the podcast that follows it up. And if you are listening on the radio, I want you to go ahead and subscribe to the podcast by going and searching What Matters in North Carolina on Apple Podcasts or where you listen to podcasts. And you can have this show and the other episodes of this show downloaded directly to your device, your phone, your tablet, your computer, wherever you listen to podcasts. And you will have this show along with you with zero effort on your part. Now, also, if you're not already following along with us on social media, you can do that by liking our Facebook page at What Matters NC on Facebook. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do the same by searching at What Matters NC as well on Twitter. And you can follow us and keep up with what's going on with the Freedom Action Network. Now, if you want to listen to more episodes of this show, our past episodes, or other shows on the network, you can do that simply by going to freedomactionnetwork.com. That is the Freedom Action Network website, where you can listen to the Frieda Brew Show from Greg Polscher, where he gets into different alcohol-related issues within the law, whether it's with beer or craft beer industry being a huge draw, or whether it is with the brunch bill that recently was passed and legislators and communities are deciding whether they want to be able to serve alcohol sooner. You can catch all of that content from Greg over at Free to Brew. Or you can listen to the NC Gun Dad Show, where you can hear me talking about different issues related with firearms, whether they're legislative or entertainment or safety, but all centered around the issue of being a father and a Second Amendment enthusiast, a gun enthusiast. So make sure you keep up with those shows and this show, and we'll catch you again next time.